higher black holes, which are rotating black holes. Now, these are the black holes that pretty much we expect to see in nature. So the Schwarzschild solution was the first solution found for a black hole, and it was pretty much within a year, I think, of Einstein putting out his theory of general relativity. Whereas this solution for the rotating black hole wasn't found, I think, until the early 60s. So that's sort of quite a huge gap. And I think it was probably mainly because of, I suppose, initially, I think people were intimidated by general relativity. Then it wasn't clear whether or not it was relevant. And finally, I think it took some time to fully understand how to find solutions and also how to decide when solutions were singular. So there was quite a debate for a while about R equals 2GM in Schwarzschild. So it's kind of, you know, sort of early 60s is really when people began to sort of feel confident that they knew how to find and interpret exact solutions in GR. So this one is important because it's what we see. Because pretty much everything is rotating in nature. We are, the Earth is, the Sun rotates. Everything you look at has some rotation. So what we're going to do is we're going to explore the metric with geodesics. Now, we'll obviously be making a lot of simplifications because actually geodesics in Kerr turn out to be a lot more complex than those in Schwarzschild. So to kind of see the reason why, what are the features of this metric? Well, you can see that although I've written it in this orthonormal type, or at least pseudo, you know, orthogonal format, you can see that when you square these two brackets up, you're going to get cross terms between phi and t. And that's kind of what's telling you about rotation. Because if you think about, you know, what it means to rotate, it's the fact that you're, you know, you choose an axis, the angle around the axis is phi, and then that phi is kind of changing in time. That's what you mean when an object rotates. And so this dt d phi piece of the metric is kind of encoding that rotation around a particular axis. So A is the parameter for the black hole that tells you about rotation. If you set A equals 0 here, you kill off those diagonal terms. So notice each of these pairings here has an A explicitly in front of it. And then if you look at what happens to gtt, delta over sigma, if you have no A, is just the usual Schwarzschild potential, 1 minus 2gm on R. Okay? So you can kind of see how this reduces to the Schwarzschild solution as you switch off A. And you can also see why it might have something to do with rotation because of these dt, d phi pieces. So the first thing before we get started, which you may have seen before, is, as always, we want to exploit symmetries in our geometry. So here, we do have killing vectors. So what does a killing vector do for us? Well, if we have a killing vector, and we're looking for solutions of a geodesic equation, let's just consider what happens if we contract, take the killing vector, the tangent vector of the geodesic, and then contract them together using the metric. So again, notice, of course, I'm using this abstract index notation, which is what we're all very used to. So d by d tau, tau is the affine parameter along the geodesic, is just the same as taking the covariant, well, it's covariant partial, it doesn't matter, this is a scalar, the covariant derivative along the tangent vector of this dot product, k x dot. Now we know that for a geodesic, an affinely parameterized geodesic, grad t of t is zero, so when this derivative hits the x dot, it just gives me zero. So this whole combination getting carried away here with my derivatives, is just simply x dot mu x dot nu times the covariant derivative of k. But of course, this is symmetric, x dot mu x dot nu, so it induces a symmetry on those indices. And one of the things that you find about the Killing vector is that the derivative along the metric, derivative along k of g, is just the symmetrized covariant derivative, which vanishes. So that means that this quantity here is conserved along the geodesic. So that means that we have a possible simplification, because if we've got a conserved quantity, it gives us a first-order equation rather than a second-order equation. So typically, the geodesic equation is a second-order equation. But if I've got x dot mu times k mu equals a constant, then that's a relation between first derivatives of x. So it typically simplifies my problem. So let's see what it does in the context of the Kerr metric. So in the Kerr metric, we simply play this game of spot the variables, and we can see that theta and r appear explicitly in the metric. Now, in the case of Schwarzschild, theta also appeared, but that didn't actually correspond to it not being a Killing vector or associated with a Killing vector. However, here, what we just have is d by dt and d by d phi. So although our object is rotating, the fact that d by dt is a Killing vector is kind of saying that, yes, it's rotating, but it's always rotating in exactly the same way. So things may not, you know, if you do a time translation, you may not get exactly, you know, something that's completely the same, but it's kind of modulo, this twist in phi, as you move along time, you've got the same geometry. Similarly, if you go around the sort of z-axis, if you go around the rotation axis, d by d phi, you also get the same geometry. So although the thing is spinning, it's not actually changing in time or around the axis. So if I look at what that means in terms of conserved quantities, it tells me that if I take d by dt and contract it with x dot using the metric, then that gives me a conserved quantity. So I'm going to label that E, because that's essentially, it's sort of related to the energy of the particle. So I write down what that is, and my conserved quantity is a combination of t dot and phi dot. So I'm going to, eventually when I discuss in detail orbits, I'm going to restrict to the equatorial plane, so I'll just write down what this becomes. There should be an R in there. Okay, so if you've done geodesics in Schwarzschild, you'll probably sort of recognize this in the sense of if you were in Schwarzschild, this is what your E would be. So setting A equal to zero, you just get the Schwarzschild potential times T dot. So for the rotational Killing vector, normally if I think about a Killing vector associated with rotation, I'll expect some sort of angular momentum to be conserved. So here, this is, I'm going to label this H. So once again, I get a combination of T dot and phi dot, and I've just written down what the limit of that is on the equatorial plane. So the fact that in our conserved quantities, T dot and phi dot mix is actually going to end up being relatively important in the sense that it's kind of telling you what the real sort of time, local time-like direction is, if you like. So we'll be coming back to this sort of once we've discussed our geodesics in more detail. But it's so far, it's kind of giving us a clue that if we're thinking about time-like directions, we shouldn't just be taking d by dt. And that's because we've got this rotation as well. Okay, so how do I use these conserved quantities to help me with the geodesic equation? Well, I'm going to pair them together in a sort of vector or covector P, which you can think of as like your sort of conserved momentum. So this is just really for convenience. I'm collecting together these conserved quantities in a little two vector. So if I now take the square of this momentum, so p squared is equal to p alpha p beta g inverse, which is the same as x dot squared contracted with g. And this is simply e squared a sort of combination of E and H. So the P squared is the sort of the same as taking the part of the tangent vector that isn't in the R direction. And this gives us this combination of E and H. So I'm going to write it down again on the equatorial plane. Okay, so that's my p squared. So why would I want to do that? Well, typically, although, as I said, the geodesic equations are second order, you usually find that you can reduce them to a first order system if you can find enough conserved quantities, because I've frozen out the theta degree of freedom by saying I'm looking in the equatorial plane. I've found conserved quantities associated with the t and phi directions. So that's like first order now. And so all that's left is the r direction. But I don't need to look at a second order equation for R because I have one remaining constraint, and that is the length of my tangent vector. If I've affinely parameterized my geodesic so that it's being parameterized by proper time, then the length of my tangent vector will be 1 if I'm dealing with a time-like geodesic, or 0 if I'm dealing with a null geodesic. And so the length of the tangent vector gives another constraint, which gives yet another first order type of equation. So this is how we find geodesics, you know, by simplifying the problem, essentially. So depending on whether we've got a massless or a massive particle, we now have our geodesic equation, okay, it's nonlinear, but the useful thing, and I think you have seen this when you've been looking at geodesics in Schwarzschild, the useful thing about the form of this equation is it can just be remanipulated into r dot squared plus some other function equals a constant, which means that you can then plot out this function, the p squared multiplied by various factors, which gives you like an effective potential for motion. So even if you don't write down exact solutions, you can qualitatively look at the different possibilities for geodesics in your space-time. So I could rewrite this. As this sort of motion of a particle in a potential well. So my V effective of R here, it's a bit of a mess for Kerr, but so this is what my effective potential is. So if I can just talk about the terms, the first bit is just a constant, and that's simply a sort of shift. Here I've said that r dot squared plus v is zero. You could have put that constant on the other side and said, well, it's e squared, okay? So this is an irrelevant piece. 2gm eta on r, well, that's the Newtonian potential that if you had a massive particle orbiting, you always get. So this term here, you always have in, you know, for any sort of gravitating object, and you have it in Newtonian gravity. This other piece here, again, if you ignore the a squared piece, you also get that in the Schwarzschild, and you also get it in Newtonian orbits, and that's like the centrifugal repulsive barrier. If something's orbiting, angular momentum is conserved, so obviously the orbit doesn't want to shrink too much. So this kind of, whereas the Newtonian part is attractive, the centrifugal part is repulsive. And so all this says is that, well, depending on whether or not eta is one, if you add in additional spin, you could get an additional push, yes?
That's an eta minus e, right?
I'm sorry?
That's an eta minus e, or the e squared.
E squared, yeah. Yeah, sorry, is it not very clear? So that's kind of saying that the rotation can provide an extra sort of resistance. However, this final piece, this is what you get also in Schwarzschild, and it's the bit that tells you gravity always wins, in the sense that if you get too close to the black hole, this is always the dominant term. So this is the piece, the extra piece in GR. So you've probably seen that in the context of looking at linearized GR in the solar system and how it perturbs the orbits, particularly close to the sun. So that's this bit. So here, notice that what's happened is this GR piece, it's formally the same, but you've shifted the angular momentum by something that tells you what the rotation parameter of the black hole is. Now notice that if h changes sign, this term, the rotation of the black hole either helps or goes against the value of h. So what this is telling you is that the sign of h gives you a different potential. So it's saying that geodesics are different if they're rotating with the black hole versus against the black hole. Now that obviously makes intuitive sense. You know, it should make a difference whether you're rotating along with the black hole or against it. But here you're actually seeing that, you know, how it comes into play. Okay, so far we haven't really done anything yet other than sort of discuss how to get an effective potential. But I want to just, you know, go into two features. I mean, one in detail, because we can do it on the blackboard analytically, and just talk about the other. Two features that you can extract using this, extract some observational information from using these sorts of equations. So I think the first one I just want to mention, though I'm not going to really discuss it in detail, mainly because when you end up actually exploring this phenomenon, you tend to do it numerically. And I kind of encourage you to go and Google and try and find some really cool videos on this, because there's some, you know, particularly in the last sort of 10 years or so, there's some very nice work being done on strong lensing and black holes. So this is like strong lensing or strong gravity. So it's really probing the near horizon regime of the black hole. And the idea is that this is really talking about null geodesics. So we know that we can, you know, if a gravitational object will lens. It lenses light geodesics. So this was one of the first experimental verifications or tests of GR, looking at the light rays bending around the sun. So that's just light rays bending around the sun is just a sort of weak lensing of light. It's something that you can think about in a linearized or approximation, or at least you can expand it around a sort of Newtonian description. However, if something is going down very near the event horizon of a black hole, you can't then sort of somehow say this is approximately Newtonian, because in no sense is it Newtonian. And so you can do this with Schwarzschild as well. If you actually try and integrate out light geodesics, you'll see they come in near the black hole, and they can sometimes whip around several times before they escape. And so there's this notion that you have what we call strong lensing around these very compact objects. And what gets quite cute about it is that what it kind of means is that you can sort of see behind the object. So in particular with a neutron star, which is about as close to a black hole as you can get, sometimes there's some nice animations where if there's some event on the surface of a black hole, normally you'd imagine, oh, well, it goes round the back of the neutron star, and you don't see it. But in fact, what happens because of the strong bending of light is you tend to sort of see round the back of the neutron star. So as this thing is rotating, you kind of, you know, you never lose sight of the glitch or some little flare. So there's some kind of nice stuff that goes on there. But mostly you have to do this, follow these geodesics numerically, simply because, you know, so much is going on. So again, the rotation of the black hole, obviously, again, it depends on whether the light is kind of co-rotating or counter-rotating. So typically, you know, your light is co-rotating. And in that case, what people do, it's more actually tracking what happens to the light as it comes from the vicinity of the black hole and kind of back to us. So typically a Schwarzschild black hole, I guess, if you kind of look at images coming from a Schwarzschild black hole, they're trying to remember what they look like. They're not kind of quite so distorted, whereas a rotating black hole kind of has a sort of different shadow or feature. So I mean, there's people at Perimeter actually working on looking at these sort of imaging of near black holes or black hole shadows or black hole. You know, you'd think, yes, you can't see a black hole. And okay, maybe you can't. But what you can see is stuff that's being guzzled by the black hole and kind of, you know, sending out its cry for help before it gets gobbled up. So I think this stuff's cool anyway. So what this does, potentially at least, is give information about the near horizon region. The other way we get information again about a very strong gravitational, strongly gravitating part of space-time is via an accretion disk, should a black hole have one. And typically, you know, black holes do not exist in a vacuum. Quite often, particularly the stellar black holes are part of some binary system. So binary systems are quite common. We've got a failed one, Jupiter and the Sun, but stars often do exist in binary systems, and one could collapse to form a black hole, and the other one is sort of like some gas giant or some other star, and the black hole just sucks material in from the other partner. And obviously, if it's part of a binary system, then it's much, much easier to see, because then it's sucking in all sorts of gases, and then that typically involves a lot of, energetic emissions.
What do you exactly mean when you say that a neutron star is as close to a black hole as you can get?
Well, in the sense of so a neutron star is, in terms of its radius, is within the same sort of order of magnitude of the Schwarzschild radius. So that's what I mean in terms of as close as it can get. It's nuclear matter, so, you know, it's incredibly dense, and if there was just a little bit more mass on the neutron star, it would exceed the the Chandrasekhar limit and would form a black hole. So it's because it is, you know, it is actually nuclear matter, so it has the density of a nucleus rather than just being a dense object where you still have an atomic type of structure.
But there are objects beyond that limit that do actually form black holes, right?
Yes. So the reason I'm mentioning neutron stars is because neutron stars have, you know, because of the structure, rather than just being a sort of hole in space-time, because they're made of matter, they tend to also have features themselves. So they, or at least we believe, they have crusts, and, you know, they rotate very fast. And we also see that they have glitches in the rotation, where suddenly, you know, the rotation kind of changes. So we think maybe they're having a sort of crust quake, or, you know, the equivalent of an earthquake on a neutron star. And so, you know, there's kind of more physics going on with neutron stars, but they're still extremely strong gravity. So they're kind of interesting from that respect. Sorry? So typically it looks something like, see if I can sketch it. So here's your black hole. And so the black hole is kind of, you know, sucking stuff off, say, some local, well, except it would be much, much bigger, wouldn't it, and further out. But let's say it's sort of stuff is being streamed in, and then it kind of, because the black hole's rotating, it kind of gets sucked into an orbit. And so you end up with this pancake-like structure, really, of things that are being pulled into the black hole. But you know, they're rotating, so they're kind of, they, you know, they could, I'm just about to discuss the orbits, so they're sort of, you can approximate one of these accretion disks. Let's just write this down. So you can approximate an accretion disk by a sort of set of concentric circular orbits. So if matter was perfect, you know, you could imagine this little annulus kind of staying there and orbiting around forever. But of course it's not. There's interactions between particles. This is actually a very, very hot and dense region of space-time. And so there's a lot of dissipation going on. So eventually, you know, the particles lose a bit of energy, they move in a little bit further and move in a little bit further until what eventually happens is they get too close to the black hole and they can no longer orbit safely. So this, you can see a circular orbit. If I sketch, and this is very much a sketch of the effective potential, this is a stable circular orbit. So here, you know, if you think about the effective effective potential, if this point is V equals zero, then R dot is zero, and R dot is zero, and R double dot is zero, and also R triple dot is going to be here V double primed is positive. So this is a stable circular orbit. If you push a little way in or out, it just oscillates around that point. Whereas this here is an unstable circular orbit, because if you push it, one way it falls in, and the other way it moves out. Yep?
Is the theta equals pi over 2 plane stable?
Yes, it is, at least in the Kerr sense. But what's really different about Kerr from Schwarzschild, which is why I've restricted to the equatorial plane, is that typically if you come off the equatorial plane, orbits are no longer lying. So with Schwarzschild, you know, they always lie in a plane which you can always, you know, turn to be the equatorial plane. Here, the equatorial plane is unique. So if you come off it, what happens is now you've got not only sort of the angular momentum of the particle, you've got the angular momentum of the black hole, and the axes of these are not aligned. So you kind of get, you know, this motion that sort of moves around and tends to sort of fill a sort of region that's, you know, like a, you know, it's limited in the theta direction, but it's still, you know, the particle kind of wanders around, it moves more freely in a sort of more of a toroidal type of region. So there is a this is where you see the distinction with Schwarzschild. But for the equatorial plane, it's kind, you know, it does work. And that was why I restricted to it, because it's close to what you've already seen, but it's adding a little bit of something new. But to find the general geodesics, you know, again, typically you'll integrate those up numerically. So all of this work here, this was again done actually in the 60s by Brandon Carter, who found, you know, and understood the role of these conserved quantities in the Kerr metric, and sort of realized that it enabled you, I think initially people probably just threw their arms up about geodesics, but he realized, no, actually, you know, it is messier than Schwarzschild, but it can be done, and you do have conserved quantities. So it's, you know, it's more complicated, but it's still tractable. It's not, you know, it's not too far out of reach. So here, this is our sort of sketch of the effective potential. And essentially, as you move closer into the black hole, this sort of local maximum and local minimum move together. So this means that you have a sort of limiting orbit beyond which you can't go. So this leads us to an important piece of terminology, I guess, for people trying to do observations of black holes. And that is, what's the limit of the accretion disk? As I look at these circular orbits and I try and make a circular orbit closer and closer to the black hole, my effective potential kind of goes through a little sequence where the maximum and minimum get closer together till they actually join, and you just get an inflection point. And that's this point at which, before they disappear, at which you've got this marginally stable circular orbit. And so we call this the innermost stable circular orbit. So that's the ISCO. So V equals V prime to zero. This is what tells us we've got a circular orbit. Then if it's stable, V double primed is positive. If it's unstable, V double primed is negative. And then gradually, these two coincide as we try to cook up an orbit that is closer to the black hole, till eventually we find a point at which V, V primed, and V double primed all vanish.
Why the V is zero?
Sorry?
Like,
yeah, because it's V is related to R dot squared. So you have to have V being zero for a circular orbit because R doesn't change. So that's why, the way I've defined V, okay, with this expression for V, V has to be zero for a circular orbit. And then if V primed is zero, it stays circular. If V primed wasn't zero, then R would change, okay? Looks like which one? The one, like this one.
The one you draw in the,
yes?
You know, one that to describe the ISD.
Yeah, so, but it's a marginally stable. So we're looking at a limiting process. As we move in, right, as we move our circular orbit in and in, the unstable, the sort of unstable circular orbit and the stable circular orbit start getting closer and closer together. So it's at this inflection point that it's just about to disappear. So obviously I'm talking about an ideal world in the sense of the ISCO is clearly, you know, a sort of infinitesimally thin particle that doesn't squeak over inside R equals R ISCO. But nonetheless, you know, it makes perfect sense as a boundary of where stable circular orbits exist. So it's the innermost region of the accretion disk. Inside that, it's not possible to orbit the black hole as a massive particle. So that represents the edge of the accretion disk. So obviously I'm talking about particles here, so eta has to be 1. And so therefore, my ISCO, I get three constraints, V, V prime, V double primed have to vanish. And if I kind of look at what my V is, if I have three constraints here, what are my unknowns? Well, my unknowns are E, H, and R. So that gives me three relations, three constraints, three unknowns. So I can invert those three equations to tell me what R is, what E is, and what H is. So here's just a couple of rewriting of constraints. So algebraically, if you're dealing with a generic Kerr black hole, you know, these are not so straightforward to invert. But for the Schwarzschild solution, they're relatively easy. And you find that R squared is 3H squared. So that's kind of coming from the top relation. And the second relation, if there's no H A squared, it just tells us that R is H squared over 2GM. So these, you don't really need the V equals 0 one for Schwarzschild. So we do have an ISCO in Schwarzschild, and it's 6GM. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what I've done is I'm writing those down simply so that, you know, you see at least some, if you want to go back and try it with Kerr yourself, you've got some simpler relations. So you simply take V, you take its derivative.
And you like kind of mix them?
Yes, it's because in this case, it's a particular, the combinations that you're getting are, you know, like the top one, you can see that it's telling you R in terms of H minus AE. So you're getting there automatically a relation between R and this reduced angular momentum. Here, it's sort of slightly different. Here you've got GMR and you've got a different combination, H squared plus A squared minus A squared E squared. And then finally with Kerr, you do need to include the effective potential vanishing. And in that case, you kind of see that here's this combination H squared plus A squared into, you know, 1 minus E squared, and here's another one, H minus AE, with a 1 over R cubed on it. So it's not sort of simple like Schwarzschild, where you can just automatically solve, you know, a very simple algebraic relation. But I was writing them down in this format so that it was partway there, and it's sort of looking a bit tidier. But of course, you can invert it with Kerr, and what you find is that with Kerr and co-rotating geodesics, the innermost stable orbit moves in. So that's what you find. The innermost, as A increases, this innermost stable orbit actually moves closer and closer to the event horizon of the black hole. And of course, as yet, I haven't discussed the event horizon of the black hole. So let's move towards that by talking about light rays. So one of the special things about GR versus Newtonian gravity is that you can actually have circular orbits of light rays around a black hole. They may not be stable, but they do exist. So to have a quick look at circular orbits, what we're going to do is we're going to rescale our affine parameter. We always can do that because we've got a null geodesic. And we're going to set E equal to 1 so that V now has a particularly simple form. It's sort of cubic. So if I look at the derivative of V, I'm going to get a relation. The first term obviously gets cancelled out. And then what's left is actually, simplifies quite nicely because I can see I've just got a simple relation for R. So then, if I now use what my radius is for this circular orbit to actually look at what happens to V double primed, then what I see is that although I do get a circular orbit, it's always unstable. So you probably saw the null circular orbit in the context of Schwarzschild and that it was unstable. And what this is saying is that rotation doesn't change that story in the slightest. It's still there, but it's also an unstable orbit. So if I now, again, I haven't said what the event horizon is, but I'm getting very close to it now. I'm going to take a specific value of the rotation parameter. I'm going to say that it's equal to the mass parameter, or GM. So if I go back and look at what I wrote down initially for the metric of the black hole and look at that delta function, r squared plus a squared minus 2gmr, if GM equals a, that's now a perfect square. And if I sort of kind of look at where that delta fits in to the metric, it's sort of multiplying one of those forms, dt minus a sine squared theta d phi, but it's also dividing dr squared. So this is sort of like about as fast as a black hole can rotate. So if I look at v equals zero, then my null orbit actually becomes where that delta, the function in the metric, vanishes. So when delta vanishes, we see we've got a coordinate singularity because we've got dr squared on delta. We suspect that's probably like an event horizon because we suspect it's not physical. But this is very curious now because it's saying that circular orbits are coming banging right up against what we suspect is the event horizon of the black hole. So we suspect then that a null orbit should lie outside this R plus region. So if I keep the same value of the angular momentum, 2a, then I get a very sort of elegant or simple form of my effective potential. So if I just sketch it, it looks something like this. So a null geodesic just outside this zero of delta escapes off to infinity and just inside It falls into the black hole. So this is kind of saying that R plus is the event horizon. So it's identifying the event horizon of our black hole as the zero of that delta function. I'm going to leave the Kerr metric up in case I want to refer to it. Another way you can see that R plus is the event horizon of the black hole is if you look at these conserved quantities, E and H, and normally what does an event horizon mean? It's the boundary between GD6 that, null GD6 that make it out and those that don't. So what you're trying to do normally to identify an event horizon is you look at null GD6 and you want to find out when do they make it out to infinity. So one way of kind of, again, a different way of seeing that is a radial null geodesic would have no angular momentum. So we set H equal to zero. Setting H equal to zero gives us a relation between phi dot and T dot. That's kind of telling us that a radial null geodesic still moves in that phi coordinate direction. If I use that relation between phi dot and T dot here, then what I'll see is that a positive T dot corresponds to a positive E, because we need to have positive energy particles making it to infinity, provided we are in the regime delta is bigger than or equal to zero. So that's another way that you see that the event horizon of the black hole is located at delta equals zero. So normally, when you think of an event horizon, you sort of look at the time component of the metric and you say, aha, that's gone to zero, that's my event horizon. And most of the time, that works. But this is an example of an instance where it doesn't work, and it doesn't work precisely because we've got this rotation or these cross terms in the metric. So if instead, this sort of leads us to something interesting about the Kerr black hole. If instead I ask, you know, suppose I have, I'm an observer, right? I might imagine that my tangent vector is d by dt. So what happens to d by dt? Well, the length of d by dt is just gtt, which is 1 minus 2gmr over the sigma function. So this equals 0 when sigma, which is r squared plus a squared cos squared theta, is equal to 2gmr. So let me compare this to my event horizon. Which is the zero of delta. So obviously these are not the same. Sorry, my call that R0. So if I look at the equator, the point at which d by dt becomes null is actually 2gm, whereas r plus is somewhat less than that. And indeed, I can see that here, that's what my extremal limit when gm equals a, r plus is actually just equal to gm, which is equal to a at this extremal limit. So this is telling us that d by d or t no longer is a time-like coordinate inside this region R naught. So what's that telling us? Well, that's telling us that an observer, if it's a normal observer inside R naught, cannot just be have a tangent vector proportional to d by dt. They've got to have some d by d phi pieces as well in order to remain time-like. And as soon as they get d by d phi pieces, that means they're moving or rotating with respect to an observer at infinity. So that means for r less than r naught, you cannot, a real observer cannot remain static or non-rotating with respect to infinity. So this is one of these interesting features about the Kerr black hole. R equals R naught is the edge of what we call the ergosphere. So it is, as it suggests, motion. It's not really spherical, but it's something topologically spherical inside which you must be moving with respect to infinity. And so this is, if I just sketch it, this is our Kerr black hole. So this is my event horizon. This is my R naught. And this region here is the ergosphere. And so this is an example of what we call frame dragging. And that is that the black hole is kind of sweeping the space-time round with it. So, so that's sort of one of those sort of curious things about the Kerr black hole, but it's also kind of interesting, you know, this idea that suddenly, you know, once we rotate, it's also demonstrating the idea that the space-time is kind of being dragged around with the black hole, and also the fact that we can't, if we want to sort of, with the Schwarzschild black hole, we can always fire rockets as long as we're outside 2GM in order to remain static with respect to an observer at infinity. We can't do that with the Kerr black hole. Eventually, we're going to get swept around the black hole, and we have to co-rotate with it. So it's, it's a messier solution, but it's obviously a very relevant solution. It's got some very interesting features, and of course, it's now that I've written it down in that format, you can also go and play with it, using the Cartan if you so wish. So I better stop there.